main thing I would like if you guys talked about the tower.
I don't have anything to contribute with that because I wasn't a part of it.
We can just title it. Yeah, we'll title it Revoke. Revoke has nothing to say about the tower. How about that? I know what it's like talking
to
him.
That's the headline.
He won't acknowledge his stature. He won't really want to talk about graffiti. I know this guy.
I'd like to talk about graffiti.
Okay, let's talk about graffiti.
I mean, I really don't have much else to contribute because it's really the only thing I've done with my life. Did you see the Catholic Church?
Yeah, I saw some of your. I love. Okay, first of all, this is the thing.
But you know, I can't admit to that. That wasn't me.
No, that wasn't you. A guy that emulates some a version of someone like you a million years ago.
Well,
maybe.
There's a lot of new blood in the crew.
There's a lot of new blood in the crew.
Exactly.
Here's what I like about you. Before I introduce who we have on the show, what I like about you is that you're not your response to that, because I followed some of it and they're like, oh yeah, you know, he's breaking the rules. This person allegedly broke the rules and wrote on the church.
Those people broke the rules.
Those people, whoever painted that church,
whomever they may be,
allegedly somebody painted a church, and then people on the internet, as they are wont to do, had a lot to say because everybody has a fucking opinion from behind their phone, and they're like, oh, you're breaking the rules like graffiti, and then my man fires back and was like, what about this? And just starts like posting Catholic abuse church stats, which I was like, yes, because that's the best retort. Like,
I mean, but specifically that church in particular, I mean, I think is responsible for something like over 5,000 isolated incidents. And not only was that church directly involved, that specific branch and all of the kind of affiliated Catholic churches throughout Southern California and the West Coast, that specific branch is not only responsible for, in the sense that they were already aware that there was an issue with these certain individuals, and they... While knowing their history or their kind of dark tendencies, almost enabled them to do so by putting them in positions to give access to these kids. And then when shit would hit the fan and something would come up, they would just shuffle them around to a different place.
Yeah.
And so essentially it's like an organized crime entity that preys on children and shields people from any kind of accountability. So how could these people be exempt from any kind of act of aggression or vandalism or whatever? I mean, these are literally people that are harming children on a massive scale and protecting and aiding and abetting and allowing this to continue to happen. So as far as I'm concerned, they should be like a primary target. You know what I mean? They're evil motherfuckers, right?
Baseline, fuck that institution for harboring that kind of bullshit.
Absolutely.
No matter what you believe in, those are the facts. I tend to be more interested in the actual facts of what's happening other than some metaphysical being who tells me that I'm not allowed to jerk off or whatever he said. I don't even know what their church says, but... There's a lot of guilt.
Not allowed to jerk off. Not allowed to use contraception.
That's good. No condoms, no masturbation, and then you just end up...
And if you're gay, you're going to hell.
You're going to hell if you're gay. And you just put on a smock and you molest kids, which is...
It's also like what? The driving engine behind, you know, colonialization, genocide, you know?
Yeah, a lot of blood on the hands of that church.
A lot of blood, yes. A lot of blood.
A lot of blood on the hands of a lot of churches, it seems.
Yes, this is true.
Yeah, so, okay, everyone, welcome to the Powerful Truth Angels podcast, television, TV show, network, cooking channel, art topic discussion, book club, movie library, fuck off fest. Today I have, and I do not fuck around and use this term loosely, and I know this is embarrassing for me to say it about you, but I'm going to say it, and again, I don't throw this around. A lot of people throw this word around a lot. I will say a legend in the game, a man known as Revoke. And arguably, maybe in my opinion, of course I'm very biased, but you can't, if you were to, not that people do this, but if people were to rate writers on a scale, and everyone does it behind closed doors and they're having their little black book parties and whatever the fuck they're smoking on, you rate who's the best. He's got to be in your top four, got to be in his era, right? I would say the Bo Jackson of the game. You could play every faction. properly and to perfection. There isn't in the categories of graffiti, from the smallest to the biggest, from, let's just say we're talking about being handsome, being a handsome graffiti guy. He ranks in that category. What if you want to chunk him and you want to get him, you want to get down with somebody, he'll do that too. Or if you just want to sit around and have casually throw around some bubble letters for fun, he'll fucking knock your hat off with those things also. So pay attention. And I want you to say hello to a friend of mine and a crewmate. His name's Revoke. And he's been in this game for a very long time, and I've known him for a very long time. And again, I'll get off your dick in a minute, but there's not a lot of people that don't seem to be able to miss. Eclipse is one of them. You're another one. I've never seen, you know, like a questionable piece. You know, like once you get out of a certain era,
yeah.
Once you get over a certain hallmark.
What's the era? What's the era where I got out of line?
I don't know. I think maybe as soon as like you left AM7. I don't know. Okay, well, his face. Now I'm in beef. Now I got beef with Krenz.
All I heard was the handsome remark, and that's the one that I appreciate.
That's the one he likes.
Thank you. You're a handsome guy, so it means a lot coming from you.
Yeah, I mean, I've always appreciated your rugged good looks. Very important in the graffiti game.
Oh, undeniably.
It's frustrating because, like, you know, there's a lot of really good graffiti writers, but they don't have the looks, they don't have the charm, you know, or they're not really good with their hands. And he's got it all. He's got all the bases covered. But that being said, Revoke, I think, is through all of this, he's a thinking man's graffiti writer, in that, like, your rebuttal to what someone said about the person that painted that piece and the church is like, you already had all this information preloaded. I don't know if that person that painted that knew that before they painted that church, but either way, most people would just respond with a fuck you, go fuck yourself. But you had actual research, which is interesting.
Everybody got Google.
Everyone got Google.
Everyone has Google.
It works for everybody.
Yeah.
So
it's true.
Revoke, originally, let's go back to way back. Originally, where did you come from?
So I was born in, Corona, California.
Okay.
My dad was born in Austria. He was like a military kid. You know, my grandfather was like in the army, and I lived everywhere. They lived Ethiopia, they lived in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Libya. My dad lived in Ethiopia when Haile Selassie's son had a coup and tried to overthrow the government.
Okay.
And my grandpa actually used to play golf with Haile Selassie. I got a photo of my dad sitting on Haile Selassie's lap feeding him cotton candy.
Holy shit.
Yeah. But then my dad had a crazy life. Like, my grandfather was like in this army unit that like trained Gaddafi in Libya.
Oh shit.
Yeah, it's like crazy. So anyways, they got like evacuated when Haile Selassie's son tried to overthrow his father, staged a coup against his father. They got evacuated out of Ethiopia, and my grandmother, my father, and my three aunts got separated from my grandfather. Obviously, this is before the era of cell phones or anything. They got evacuated. My grandfather was like somewhere else. He didn't know if they were alive or dead. They basically lost contact for like 3 months, and they reconnected through the military, because obviously they were evacuated to the military. I think in like Libya or something, mm-hmm. or somewhere like that. And then eventually at some point they came back to the United States. I think they were like in Illinois for a while or whatever. My grandmother actually was from Nashville. My grandfather met her in Nashville. So they were there for a minute, and they ended up settling back in Riverside, California. So my dad went to high school out there. My mother was born and raised in Norco. Mm. You know where that is? Like horse country in the Inland Empire. Mm. So my mother's whole side of the family is from Norco. My dad's side of the family is from all over. They're more or less like kind of the Inland Empire area. And I was born in Corona. And then I lived in Corona, Riverside. My dad moved. We lived in Apple Valley for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
My dad moved us to Phoenix because for whatever reason, he took my mother to Phoenix, and then my mother left my father, took me with her back to Riverside. That wasn't a cool situation. So then I ended up leaving after like a couple years. I left.
What was shitty about the Riverside situation?
Just, you know, family stuff, you know.
Okay, family
and,
stuff.
And so anyways, I ended up going to live with my father. I was in Phoenix again for a few more years, and then I think I went back to Riverside. I think it was like seventh grade, I went from Phoenix. I was like the only kid that, actually, I used to skate. And I started skating really, that became like my real shit that I was really into, like in the mid 80s, you know, like 84, 85, 86 was when I really got heavy into skating. I was young. I was like 9, 10, 11. That's when I first discovered hip hop. I used to go to do Taekwondo. And these two kids that I trained at the Taekwondo school I trained at were from New York. Their mom had shipped them out from New York. They were from Queens. And they were like already really into hip hop and graffiti. So they actually introduced me to graffiti and hip hop. And there used to be, it's so crazy now looking back at it, thinking about it, because this was like maybe 80, 86, 87. There was a store in I think it was like Tempe, Arizona called Smitty's. It was basically like a Target or like a Walmart or something today. I think it was like an Arizona chain, but they had like a music section. They had like this is like 86, 87. They had like a crazy thorough like hip hop section. It's like Boogie Down Productions, Kool G Rap. Eric B. Rakim. I think the very first hip hop CD or tape I ever stole was like Fat Boys Crushing with like them in the car with a crushing piece, you know?
Yeah.
I got Ice-T 6 in the Morning there.
Oh, yeah.
So they had this like crazy collection of hip hop like in suburban Phoenix in like the mid 80s. So, and it was through these guys, Nick and I can't remember his older brother, but there it is.
This is the first tape I bought. Ever LL Cool J Radio on the boardwalk.
Amazing.
I just brought all my tapes in
there. Yeah, I think I stole that like in fourth or fifth grade or something.
Crazy.
Yeah. So I was there and then like, you know, so and then we moved back to Riverside and I was in Riverside. We lived like in this neighborhood, Casablanca. I used to go to this junior high school, Gage Junior High School. And that was like a bit of a reality check coming from suburban Phoenix. Like, all of a sudden, I was like the only white boy getting jumped every day, like getting jumped by Rolling 60s one day, getting jumped by the Southsider gang, Casablanca the next day. It was just hell. You know, they put me through hell.
Yeah.
So I had already had like a little bit of like an introduction to graffiti from these two brothers. One of them had like a black book and they had some photos or something. And I remember seeing that Ice-T, that first record, Rhyme Pays, and the inside, when you open up the inside, there was that whole burner that Dream had done.
I
remember that was the one that like really made a big impression on me. I was like obsessed with like the bullet holes and shit, and like the Uzi with the Kangol. And yeah, I was like so high. I just, for whatever reason, I was like obsessed with it. And then I had an older cousin that lived up in Stockton and I would often go spend time with him and we went and saw Breakin'.
Yeah.
And I saw Breakin' and that just like that kind of sequence of events at that time, just like, you know, like things that like weren't in the mainstream then.
Yeah.
Were like whenever you got like a little piece of media, whenever you got a little taste of it, it was so special. You know, it's not like now where like anything you're interested in, you could just go down the rabbit hole instantly and learn everything about it. Like, so you know, especially being like suburbia then, like just getting those little tastes of like graffiti and hip hop, you just soaked it up. And I think that now I've always kind of, years later, I find myself really kind of feel like a connection to people that are like outsiders, and like outsiders in the sense of like, I didn't grow up in like Los Angeles.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up like in the suburbs and the outside, just like wanting so bad to be a part of that scene and like to be immersed in that scene.
Yeah.
And like, so I think that like all those little things, I just obsessed that much more over it and just like studied it so much harder. And so anyways, like
it creates a funnel for you to want it even more, because in the city you're accessible. Like I was going on the boardwalk and seeing people break dance and pop lock and like it was everywhere.
Yeah.
Whereas like you're in the suburbs, was watching through a goddamn fucking Zoom,
and there's nothing going around. So you're just so hungry and thirsty for anything. Yeah.
The Ice-T album cover, The Dream. Let's see if I can grab this without fucking stopping the show. But The Dream cover, that shit fucked me up so bad, because I think I had it on vinyl too. And that,
what year? That record's like what, 87?
That album cover, that piece, still to this day, when I think about, I still reference it. I still think about two things happen. Darlene and that piece fucked me up.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah,
Darlene, you're going to Darlene, puberty. You see Darlene, queen, yeah,
and that G string.
Yeah, that shit. That shit was like a young, horny mind.
Yeah.
Seeing Darlene on the album cover, you don't even have access to porn yet. If it made me just go, "What the fuck is?" And then that in the graffiti, and it was just like,
it's like that's everything I want. In my
it's
life.
All right there. Yeah. How do I get to this shit right now?
Exactly.
Both of those things I need to have. And
exactly.
And the piece is still to this day, like it's still to me untouchable. That Ice-T logo is like one of the best things I've ever seen. Like it's,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's amazing. I still fucking reference it. I mean, I'm still It's influencing this thing I'm drawing. I drew years later of a Smurf with an Uzi, which I just brought back out of retirement. I'm redrawing it now. All based on that fucking album cover.
Should do a Born Raised like that logo.
Yeah, I guarantee you that I've taken a crack at it and failed. Because it's, as simple as that thing is, it's not hard. It's hard.
It's tough.
Yeah, it's hard to pull that off. Yeah, that shit. I remember those pivotal things. And before you get your hands on spray can art and shit, which is just another, like, once that happens, you're just like, you're as a young graffiti fucking toy, your brain just melts. You're like, what?
I think I got my hands on spray can art. I think it was like the summer of eighth grade, after eighth grade, like going into ninth grade.
Yeah.
I got my hands in that book, and I mean, that shit changed my life.
Yeah, you know,
that was my Bible.
Yeah.
You know, like I could sit here and like probably quote every quote in the piece. I could tell you about like the Doc TC5 Doe's battle like, you know, ground zero, all arrows pointing.
Arrows pointing inwards to destroy itself.
Yeah, that just was everything. Like that was everything for me. So it's funny. I find from my generation, there's kind of like two different types of graffiti writers. There's the guys who gravitated way more towards subway art.
Yeah.
And then there's the guys that gravitated more towards spray can art.
You're right.
For me, like subway art was like dope, but like spray can art is like it's shit's evolved. It's gotten tighter. Styles evolved better. Yeah. And it's like that was the one for me. Yeah.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now look, a lot of us out here, especially, you know, people in certain subcultures, probably I would say 70% of us, latchkey kids, come from broken homes. Why are we out here painting on shit? Why do we vandalize things? Why are we staying up till 4 a.m, painting on walls, climbing over fences, cutting holes in things? I don't know. Maybe it's because your mom didn't hug you enough. Maybe the old man left too early. Maybe Uncle Bertie got a little too touchy at the fucking family reunion. I don't know what the fuck happened to you, but you might need some help. Okay. And that's when BetterHelp comes in. You know, sometimes we all get run down. We're in an era where people can admit to mental health being an actual thing. Just like, you know, you break your arm, you put on a cast, sometimes your brain breaks. Sometimes it's not working right. Sometimes you're depressed, you can't get out of bed, or you're manic, or you're angry all the time. Sometimes you're too fucking happy. And sometimes you need help. And the first thing about getting help is admitting that you need some help and looking for some help. I got one. Are you a person that decides to spend $36 on a smoothie from a health food store? I might need some help. I'm going to need to talk to someone about that. Doesn't make any goddamn sense. Could have made this at home for $3. It can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. What's the right amount of socializing for you? And how do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need some time alone. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. Do you get drained sometimes when you go out? You need to go home by yourself, or are you just like, fuck it, let's keep going?
I'm perpetually drained. That's one of my biggest challenges in life. Energy.
Energy.
Yep.
Talking to a man that clearly has a lot of energy. If you want to look at his fucking portfolio, you'll know that the guy's been putting in work. And even in this man, cops to being drained at times. Me personally, I'll just say this. I'm a maniac. I talked to Tim. I talked to GK the other day. Me personally, I can cop to being totally insane. And I know that that's not the vernacular we're supposed to use when we talk about our mental health, but that's the vernacular I choose to use. With other words, I'm not allowed to say. And I'm a person that I would say if I hadn't gotten help, I don't know if I would be here today, because I was probably on a collision course with an institution or a burial plot because of my mental state. I got it under control. Lots of therapy, lots of fucking exercise, lots of meditating, lots of praying, lots of fucking groups. I do everything I can to keep my head above water, because that's kind of a full-time job for me. Okay, so look, I'll just say this. I'll be completely honest. I've been in therapy for a very long time. I was lucky enough to get access to a therapist. I stuck with her. She carried me through some of the hardest times of my life. I had a terrible year last year. It was fucking insane. I didn't know if I was coming or going. I think without all that fucking therapy and learning self-introspective stuff, I don't know if I would have made it through these things in one piece. Whatever that means to you, I don't know what to tell you, but I'll tell you that I couldn't be anywhere that I am without having had all that time to reflect on what made me the person I am. And I come from a very bizarre and weird place, like a lot of us do, and therapy has helped me navigate it. And that's the truth. And, you know, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. I think it would be easy to do. I think it's probably a lot easier than talking to a person face-to-face. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. It's on your fucking dime, bucko. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. If you don't like that your therapist is 6 years younger than you and has a nose ring, fuck her. or fuck them, or fuck them all, and get a new shrink. Get an old man who seems like he has a knowledge of a gnarled up tree. You know, get someone with some fucking wisdom. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/PTANGELS. That's PT Angels today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/PTANGELS. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/PTANGELS. PTANGELS, BetterHelp.com.
Thank PT you. Angels sounds like a cam girl website or some shit.
Don't go to PTAngels.biz because that's a whole different site.
.ch.
We all made a decision to become graffiti writers. I remember as a kid being like, this is it. I got to do this. You know, like I was like, I gotta write graffiti. I gotta be down with this crew. My whole focus in life was to do graffiti for like a very long time. And I think that like in hindsight, in retrospect, a lot of us, not all of us, but a lot of us came from questionable circumstances at home. You know, I think that the guys that had like all the nurturing support and all the fucking resources, that's not everybody, because there's a lot of guys that came from a perfect place and end up being monsters.
Yes, this is true.
But I think I would guess a good portion of us were maybe missing something at home and needed to feel like I wrote graffiti because I wanted to know that I existed, because I felt like a fucking ghost, I think, right? Mm. So I knew that if I came outside the next day and I saw my name on a wall, I was like, okay, I'm here. I'm in this shit. And it gave me a sense of like, I don't know, like it was like a, it's a weird thing because it gives you a sense of like presence and like it gives you like a confidence boost. And then you're also playing with the fame game. Because every graffiti writers, you're out for fame, right? It's all about fame. It's all about becoming known to your peers as the fucking one, right? And you know, bombing, tagging, and then that it becomes a fame game, and then after it becomes a fame game, it's just a fucking addiction. And then if you stay in long enough, you become so good at graffiti that you can't ever quit. Because I feel like once you get to a certain point in graffiti, you'll never stop. Like, and I didn't even get to that point, and I've never stopped even just like writing on shit constantly. Like I thought at some point I would be like, okay, I'm hanging up that part of my life. I'm never going to think about it again. I can't stop thinking about writing it, talking about it, you know, even though I don't do it anymore, even though I'm fucking washed. So I kind of drifted off the subject here, but the main thing I wanted to ask you was, do you think there's a correlation between graffiti writers and like how they grew up at home?
Yeah. I mean, there has to be. I mean, you know, I've spent, what am I, 47 now? You know, I've spent really all of my life. And from the moment I had any kind of real independence, all my life has been doing graffiti and hanging out with graffiti writers. And it seems evident to me that just about everybody, you know, at least people that like do it enough to like that you want to fuck with them and actually get to know them, they all have these kind of common characteristics and traits where they, you know, come from some kind of fucked up dysfunctional situation or whatever. You know, with me personally, I've spent a lot of time thinking about it. You know, I never really wanted to do anything else. I don't know why. You know, I remember when, because so like, I spoke on a little bit earlier, growing up, like I just moved around constantly, you know, like I don't have, you asked me like, where am I from? I'm not really from anywhere. I don't have any like childhood friends. I'm not even in any yearbooks or anything. I never started a school year in my life and finished the school year at that same school. Hmm. Like I just moved constantly. You know, I had mentioned again before, my dad like had this kind of crazy nomadic military childhood where he just like, they were just moving constantly. Like, and by moving, that often meant like moving to different countries. Hmm. So I think it was just normal for him. It felt natural for him to just like, oh yeah, this isn't working out or whatever. I'm like, I'm not happy with this. Like, let's go. You know, and you know, you're a kid, obviously you have no say, you're just kind of along for the ride. So I was always very, I think I'm probably a bit underdeveloped socially, because I never had like strong kind of social or community really bonds or connections. You know, I was always a new kid. I was always like this like unknown kind of weirdo at every school that I would go to, and which usually was like every 6 months or something. So yeah, like I was totally, I guess in some ways I benefited because like I wasn't into like what my friends are doing. I was just into what I was doing. So I had like long hair down to my ass, wore like Public Enemy shirts and skated, you know, yeah. Like people were just like, what the fuck's wrong with you? Like, are you a Hesher? Or are you a Wigger? You know, like, I just did my own thing, you know? And I think that maybe at some point though, you know, I had like an amazing, at the same time though, I had an amazing childhood. Like my dad was super rad. Like I used to race motocross, not two wheels, but like first on three wheelers and then later quads, like all the way up till I was 18. Like I used to race like the Grand Nationals, like Pro-Am circuit.
Oh, that's crazy.
I had like a rad dad who was like super supportive and like, that was like his thing. Like he always wanted to do that as a kid growing up. So he kind of did it vicariously through me.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so I did that, and then like I did like Taekwondo from the time I was like 7 all the way up to I was 18. I got my black belt. I used to compete in like the state championships and the national championships. Like I trained like 4 days a week, you know, from the time I was like probably 10, 11 all the way up to 18. Like, you know, my dad was super supportive, allowed me to do that. Plus I skated in skate contests all the time. You know, my dad was rad, man. Like he was super supportive. Like, and I always pissed off my stepmom, you know, because we were always like every weekend we were like at a race or doing something and you know, she was probably a bit jealous of that. So I had this amazing dad, but I also had like a really fucked up, dysfunctional home. And like the situation, my mother was like always like not healthy or functional. But anyways, like, you know, I don't know why I wanted to do graffiti so much, but I don't think I really quite understood it at the time. And it wasn't like my intention or plan, but I think I eventually, after spending a lot of time, you know, alone in my studio talking with myself, I kind of came to this realization that like, I really liked the idea of like owning my identity, because wherever I went, you know, like I said, I was always a new kid. I didn't have any friends and I was having to like try to make some kind of connections with kids and get to know them and have them be interested enough in me to get to know me. But everybody always saw me through this like lens of like whatever they thought I was based on the way I look, you know? Mm. And I was always, for whatever reason, really dissatisfied with that. So I like the idea of having complete ownership of who I was, like that right down to my name. Mm. So I made this name for myself. And then I went out and did this thing. And it's kind of like, you're only going to get as much out of it as what you put into it. So the more effort and energy I put into it, the more I felt was kind of coming back to me. And that made me feel good. You know, when you're like a young teenage kid, I mean, validation and respect from your peers really is like everything to you. So that, for whatever reason, that stuck, you know. And I remember just tripping out like the first time meeting a another writer that was like 18. And I was like, oh shit, like you're 18 years old and like you still tag. Like, damn, like are you a fucking, what's wrong with you? You know? But then on the flip side, I was like, oh shit, like I can still keep doing this shit, you know? And I never had any other ambition. Like I wasn't like I always knew that like my dad always told me like, you better learn to do something and get a scholarship because like I can't afford to send you to college.
Yeah.
So I never felt like I was risking any future or anything. It's not like there was something else at stake that was in jeopardy by me just being like a full-time criminal and painting graffiti all the time.
Yeah.
Because really, I couldn't even imagine any other future for myself. That's really all I ever wanted to do. And all through my early adult life and then well into my, you know, fully developed adult life, whatever it was I did to like pay my bills or make money really was just an ends to a means to be able to just continue to paint graffiti. You know, all I really cared about was like painting graffiti and partying. You know, that for me, that's what life was.
Yeah.
Like it wasn't like one day I'm going to like have this successful career and like buy a house and have a family. Like I was those things. I just never even considered those things. I just wanted to paint graffiti, like Risk and like Crush and like Tyke and like you and like Saber and like GK and Charlie, you know, and Skill, Charlie, yeah. You know, those, I just want to be able to paint graffiti as good as those guys. I just want to be up like Euler was up,
yeah.
You know, like that was my life's ambition and goal.
Yeah.
You had spoken a little bit about, kind of getting to a point and then like, you know, asking yourself, like, do I want to continue to do this? Or like, can I even quit? For me, I never even considered it because there was nothing, there's never really, not until I came to a place where I started having ideas that I was really excited about doing that didn't fit into the context of graffiti.
Yeah.
Did I ever want to do anything else?
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't until I started thinking like, oh, I want to, I want to figure out how to like kind of have this space so I can make this weird shit.
Yeah.
That isn't about like going out painting my name on the street.
Yeah.
That was the first, that probably happened in like my early 30s or something. Yeah. And it wasn't until that happened that I ever even imagined any other kind of life or future for me. You know, it's like I'm married now. I have a kid. I have a super lucky. I have like the most amazing wife, you know, raddest kid ever. I have an 11-year-old daughter, you know, like I own property and shit now. Like that was never my plan.
Yeah,
you know?
I
never set out with like, this is going to be my goal. One day I'm going to have this.
Yeah.
I just got lucky enough to meet like a girl I fell in love with. That was amazing. And like, that shit just happened.
And she's
like,
down to ride too.
She's super down to ride, but she also wants like an adult, you know?
Yeah.
I'm like 47 years old and I'm still trying to figure this adult shit out, you know?
Because I've
been in perpetual childhood, you know?
We can cut this from, I gotta tell you about this thing I remember. We can cut this too. You probably want to cut this, so. Jason, cut this. But I remember way back in the day when you first started dating her.
My girl? No.
And we were in the back of, I don't know if it was Norm's shop yet, but we're back in Norm's shop. Everyone's drunk and like, she was getting into with some girl. And I'm like, they just started fighting.
You were there?
Yeah.
When they put on the gloves, they started boxing?
I don't know if they had gloves, but I know they were scrapping.
Uh-huh.
And I remember looking at you, and you were just like, like, you were so proud of her.
She whooped her ass.
She whooped her ass. And I just remember you just being like, yeah. And I was like, God damn, these fools are savages.
My girl's fucking nuts, man. She's like 100 pounds. She's like, she's like a fucking grizzly bear.
Yeah.
It's part of the reasons why I like her so much.
Yeah. You know, before we go into what you're doing now, let's talk about top LA yards, not just spots. Like, what are your favorite? Like, what are the yards that you're fondest of? We spent a lot of time in yards.
The only one I ever cared about was Belmont.
Belmont was your yard.
I didn't really care for any of the other ones.
Motor, you didn't fuck with Motor.
I mean, I painted there.
Yeah.
Once I got in the crew, I painted there because that was like, I always thought of that as like, you know, MSKWR yard.
Yeah.
So I would paint there just to go paint there with homies. But I never liked that yard. I didn't like that, fools could come in and it's just that long at you.
The tunnel's
trapped
crazy.
In this long at, yeah. And like, seemed like somebody always had a gun and was shooting at somebody there.
Yeah. The tunnel's fucked up.
Yeah, the tunnel's fucked up. I like Belmont because Belmont, for me, it felt just like the nucleus of LA.
Yeah.
You know? And like, not just like geographically, but, you know, it was in the center of LA where like the west side and the east side came together. You know, LA always had this kind of like split scene, you know? And it felt like this kind of convergence of like all of LA kind of converged right there in the center. And just the way that it was, for me, it felt like a gladiator arena, you know?
Yeah,
like right there off the street, like this big, massive open pit with this like crazy tunnel at the end.
Yeah.
It felt like a fucking Roman arena, you know? And I just, there was something about that place. I mean, when I was like a kid, you know, we used to we ditched school to be like some older fool with a car. We'd all drive to LA. And like, that was always the first stop, you know, get off and go to Belmont, see what was up at Belmont. And that was like the first time I started seeing like Krenz up, seeing like old Krenz pieces there.
Yeah.
And he always had that piece on the right down the street from there. It was like Beverly and Reno. There was a liquor store.
Yeah.
He always had like a burner on that liquor store.
Yeah.
And so for me, I always just identified that as like, that was kind of like the throne room of LA, you know?
Yeah.
So that was the only yard it ever really like mattered to me to like paint have a really good piece up there at. And, you know, I think I probably collectively spent close to like 23, 24 years in L.A. And, you know, broken up into kind of sections. And like whenever I've been living here, it's always been important for me to like have a good piece there. So when that yard was gone, that was like an end of a real kind of special
end of an era.
Era for sure. Yeah. Absolutely.
That was the archetype of a yard. Like
I've seen so much crazy shit there.
Oh, bro, I've seen. You know what's funny too is like you'd be painting there on a Sunday, and you turn around, there's a full fucking huge soccer game in the middle.
Oh yeah.
It's like these fools are just going out. They don't give a
fuck. They played this other crazy game. It was like, it wasn't soccer. It was like some other, it's like some Mayan game or something.
Yeah.
That all these dudes would meet there. It would be like 20 on 20.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah. It was huge.
Yeah.
Yeah. And these fools would be in their fucking jeans playing this shit with the dust everywhere.
That shit was dope.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember once I went there to paint, and all the CBS guys were already painting there.
Yeah,
and that dude was crazy as fuck. I remember like some gangster tweaked out came down there tripping, and he pulled a pistol out and was like, he was just going along the wall, like just jacking everybody, running everybody's pockets, taking all their shit.
Yeah,
and he got the grabbed the pistol and like put it at his head. He's like, "You're gonna shoot me, motherfucker! Shoot me!" And the guy fucking hesitated. He snatched the pistol out of his hand and fucking beat this fool down with his own pistol.
Oh wow!
Yeah, he was a nut. I seen all kind of. Maybe I don't know if we should say that in the podcast. Maybe edit that part out. But yeah, I seen the craziest shit happen there. That place is wild.
I had some time. I definitely got chased out of there before. For some reason, I don't know why, but they just every once in a while, a cop would be like, "Ah, oh, let's."
Did you ever go to the end of the tunnel?
Once or twice, yeah.
You did,
yeah, but
did
not,
you paint down there?
I've painted in the tunnel.
Yeah,
yeah, but not too deep in that.
I think
tunnel.
GK with GK Chunk and like Tempt or somebody, they went all the way to the very end and painted pieces. I think down there.
That makes sense.
So it's kind of sick. You think about that. It's like sealed. That's like a time capsule. It's sealed forever. Like that's a crazy part of LA history that will kind of, unless I guess until like an earthquake. Makes the fucking tunnel collapse or something. I mean, it's going to be sealed in there forever.
That's crazy.
Maybe like in 100 years, they'll start building subterranean levels or something, and that shit will pop up.
Cave drawings, man.
Yeah.
GK, just the first day he was out of jail, we go to Motor. First day. One of the first days. He comes out of jail. We go to Motor. All of us are there. The whole fucking crew's in Motor painting. We're painting in the back. And I'm walking through the tunnel with Chunk, and then Chunk's up ahead, and I turn. He turns toward me. He goes, "Break out, fool, break out." And he just starts, you know, he's a little fucking, he's like, starts running. it takes me a second to register, and I look, and I just see cops coming down. And I start fucking running. And somehow, like, of course, the only person to get caught is Tim, GK. And I remember, like, I booked it up the embankment, up to the freeway. And I remember, like, as I was going up, the cops were coming down the other side, too. And he was the only one left. I'm like, of all the fucking luck. And we got to that like gas station up above Motor, and like we're calling everyone, calling people around, and like, dude, he got fucking busted. Like right the fuck, like he wasn't even out for hours. And they fucking got his, it was like they honed in on him like a fucking magnet.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah, he had bad luck with that type of stuff.
Yeah, 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 he did. Yeah.
I have a good podcast chase story. Casey used to, I don't know how he would do it. He would always magically kind of find some company, like, you know, pitch him this project and get him to pay for like 40 or 50 of us to go somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was a when he was really full on with Seventh Letter, there was a few years where like a couple times a year he would like, we go on these like 40 person plus trips to like Tokyo, Taipei, yeah. Korea. And we went to Barcelona one year. I think he had gotten somebody to pay for us to do like an art show at like Bread and Butter or something like that.
Yeah.
And I think 48 of us all flew in one flight together to Barcelona. and you know, what you would expect to happen was happening. But there was like, so Barcelona has like this port where like cruise ships go in and out, probably cruise ships kind of hopping all around like the Mediterranean or something. And they have this, port where the cruise ships go in and out, and they built like an artificial, like a dike or a jetty. I don't know what you call that. But it's basically like a curb that goes like, it extends like 2 miles out into the ocean. And it's like a wake break to kind of create like a steel harbor for like those big cruise ships to go in and out. And the way that they made this thing is they like cast these like concrete blocks. They're like 8x8 concrete stones. And they just like drop them in the ocean, like build them up and build this like artificial kind of landmass or whatever. So we had heard somebody had told us like, oh, it's a cool spot to paint or whatever. So like we all went out there. Like I remember Esteban was there, Keegan Gibbs was there. We had all these people with us. I think that was the first time Hale had ever left the country.
Yeah.
And there was a bunch of us out there. Anyways, we're all out there painting. The Os Gemios were out there. A bunch of Spanish guys were out there. We're all out there painting this thing. Cause like on one side, it's like all these cubes all stacked up, and on the other side, it's just a massive like 40-foot concrete wall, and it faces all the cruise ships. So we were out there in the day, like all painting this wall. We had to like hop a fence, and there's just one way in and one way out, you know? So we hop this fence and we all go out there, and we're all along this thing painting, and the cruise ships are going by, and like girls are flashing us, and we're like, you know, it's hot as fuck. It's like summer in Barcelona, like me, Esteban, Hale, like diving off this thing, swimming in the ocean, coming back up, painting pieces. And all of a sudden somebody's like, oh shit, like cops are coming. And we look, and it's like, I mean, this thing's probably like a mile and a half long or something. And you're just like on like a sidewalk, basically, in the middle of the ocean. And it's just this all the way back to like land. And there's like a gate and the street. And these cops are like, there's like maybe like 6-7 cop cars all lined up at the fence. And they're trying to figure out how to get through the fence or open up the gate to come and get us. And we're like, oh shit, like what are we gonna do? Should we jump in the ocean? Like try to swim around this thing? So somebody was like painting far enough down. They saw like a staircase. Oh, and Joe was with this girl at the time that was a writer, and the two of them had just disappeared. We didn't know where they were. We thought they had left and gone somewhere else. So there's like 30 of us painting. The cops are coming. They finally figure out they got someone to open the gate or something, and they get in their cars, and they're starting to drive down this long-ass driveway into the middle of the ocean to come get us. So we ran the opposite direction, found the staircase, went up the staircase up over this like 40-foot wall onto the other side, and we get to the other side, and it's like all these like massive stone concrete cubes, and they're like kind of staggered and all stacked like haphazardly. It's like that game Q-Bert. Remember Q-Bert? Where you're like the little dude and you like hop from platform to platform.
Yeah.
So we were basically doing that. And then we got this like group of like 20 cops behind us chasing us. And we got maybe like 50, 60 yards on these fools. And we're like climbing them, hopping stone to stone, like a mile and a half back to, we don't even know what's on the other side. And we end up like, there's like a part where like they're really high and we come over, and as soon as we come over, Joe's got this girl doggy style. And they have like two half painted pieces right there on this little wall. And he's got her, and we're like, Joe, come on, the cops are coming. He's like, yeah, what are you talking about? He's like, put your fucking clothes on. The cops are right behind us. So they stop throwing their clothes on. And we're all like Esteban was there. A bunch of people were there. I can't remember who else was there, but you could ask them their version of the story too. And anyways, we're like hopping cube to cube. The cops are hopping cube to cube behind us like a video game trying to get to us. And it fucking took forever. But we finally, like, we start hearing like dooch, 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 like house music, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we're like, oh, shit, we must be getting close to the beach. We come over like this like high part and like, boom, we can see the beach. And it's just like, it's at this point, it's like 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
But it's still like, you're still getting sunburned. Like the sun's going. The beach is fucking raging. There's like hundreds of people at the beach. They have DJs set up on the beach. Everybody's dancing. And we're coming down off these stones, like, oh, let's just run onto the beach, fucking stash our shit, and jump in the water and just act like we're here at the beach. Like they haven't been that close to us. They don't know what we look like. We'll get away. We start seeing dicks everywhere. We're like, what the fuck? It's like a fucking full-blown fucking like naked beach party, like a gay naked beach party, and it's just like an ocean of dicks, dude. Like everyone's butt naked, and like and Esteban, the reason why I keep bringing them up is because they're like big bald headed, just fully tatted dudes, and it's like fresh meat, like all eyes are on them.
Yeah,
like everyone's just like, oh shit, like lock in on them. And we're like, strip our shit off. Not our bottoms, but we strip our shit off and like jump in the water. We're just kind of like dancing, like trying to blend in. And all of a sudden, all these fucking cops start coming over this wall down onto the beach, and like they're just as like surprised as we are.
Yeah.
And everyone starts yelling shit at him in Spanish, and like guys are going up to him, like touching him, like oh, it was the best. We got away, obviously, but yeah, that's the story.
That's fucking amazing. Yeah. If I saw that in a movie, I'd be like, this is ridiculous.
Yeah, that's a good one.
That's fucking crazy.
Yeah, I think there might be video footage of it because Esteban was shooting like Super 8 the whole time.
The Seventh Day Project. Fuck.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I love the half finished piece. And Rhyme just fucking waxing homegirl. Like, that is just like, I just like the idea of the piece not done. Like they just got so overcome by romance.
But it was funny because we first popped over. He was stoked. He was like, hey, what's up, guys? Like, he was very proud, you know? He's like,
what a maniac. Fuck. I mean, listen, you don't get to have stories like that if you're not, it's crazy. There's nothing like it. No. Nothing like, you know, strange. Truth is always stranger than fiction. Like I would never. That is hilarious.
That was a fun trip. We all of us, 48 of us, were all staying at this one little hotel right at the top of La Rambla. It's like this, like, have you been to Barcelona, haven't you?
Yeah, yeah.
You know La Rambla, it's like all the hookers, it's like the party streets, like a cobblestone street.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like a little maze.
Every you walk down the alley, like a gangbang going on. Yeah, like absolutely out of control.
Yeah.
So we were staying at this little motel there, and this one fool from the Bay Area, I'm trying to remember what he wrote, he like somehow found out we were going there, and he like followed us and was like stalking us basically and like tagging along. And he ended up with Lee, Casey, and a couple people one night, basically like tagging along with them, like tagging and stuff, just creeping around those little alleys. And they ended up getting rolled on and getting arrested. And this fool told them what hotel we were staying at.
Oh, hell no.
So, like I said, there's 48 of us. We had like more than half the rooms in the hotel. And the fucking hotel gets raided by the Barcelona police. And they showed up like at 3 a.m, like in the middle of the night. I don't know. So many cops. Like, so, like, I remember looking out the window. It was just all cop cars in the parking lot. And they just, the front desk, they told them all the rooms that the Americans are staying in. And they just started going to every room, banging on the doors. But nobody opened the doors. Not one single person opened the doors. And I guess they, whatever the laws are there, they can't, like, they can't get access or something. Maybe they didn't have a warrant or something. I don't know what the laws are, but they, for whatever reason, they didn't bust down any doors and they didn't have like some master key from the management.
Oh, shit.
So they just sat outside at every single person's door that they knew was an American, banging on their door for like 20 minutes, and nobody gave in and opened the door, and they all just gave up and left.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was fun.
Damn, that fool snitched. That's crazy. That is fucking, I mean, that's a, wow. A fucking fantastic show. Revoke One, MSK, AWR, OTR. Where else is this guy from?
That's it.
Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah, I love that. Shout out to OTR. Shout out to AWR. Shout out to MSK. Shout out to Merch. Shout out to Worth. All the homies, Alloy, et cetera, Zest, everyone we talked about. Shout out to Might, Crush, Tyke. You know who you are, you guys. Cokes, Laps, Sloan, all the guys. My boys. So I don't know. It's
shout out to Sponto.
Shout out to Sponto. Of course, shout out. You and Sponto were home. It was funny watching Sponto interact with guys in my crew, because it was just like sometimes there'd just be like that alpha energy. And sometimes people butt heads.
He was great for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was an awesome dude. Amazing guy.
Yeah.
It's a real, that's a real big loss, man. That's a real tragedy. I had a lot of respect and love for that dude. He's a good dude.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's one of a kind.
I met him before Born and Raised.
Yeah.
We used to hang out and party all the time.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. We used to party quite a bit.
No shit.
Yeah. The first time I met Sponto, I believe, he gave me a ride back from ASR. Or what was the Vegas one?
Magic.
He gave me a ride. Him and he used to date the chick that owned Taroni.
Oh, yeah.
And the two of them gave me a ride from Magic. Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, I think I had met him with Casey or something. And, like, I don't know what happened. I ended up seeing him. And he was just like, yeah, you need a ride. I just jumped in the car with him and his chick, and we hit it off. He was a real cool dude. Yeah, I had a lot of love for that dude.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm bummed that, I'm really bummed he's no longer here. He had an amazing energy. He was like this guy. He was one of those guys that people really had a lot of respect for and rallied around. He was able to somehow bring all these different people together because he just had that kind of energy. You know?
I used to say he's irrepressible.
Yeah.
Never stopped moving, never stopped running around. And he was out in the fucking streets every goddamn day.
Yeah.
He rallied
people. Yeah.
You know, it was a skill that, like, I don't have it. I don't have that energy. He had endless energy.
Yeah, me neither. I'm not that guy.
No, I'm not that guy. Well, thank you for coming on Revoke.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate you, homie.
All right, brother.
Always a pleasure. See you.